Last night at dinner, I tried to get Dr. Lara Strick to my right here to admit that she is one of a kind. And after we clarified that I was talking about professionally, and yes, of course, personally, she is one of a kind and a gem in every way, I believe I did finally get the admission that she is the only dedicated full-time DOC infectious disease physician in the country. That is, in Washington State, she is a full-time Department of Corrections employee who provides infectious disease services to every prisoner in the Washington State Department of Corrections. And she is a consultant to the Washington State Department of Corrections. In that role, she oversees the statewide prison hepatitis C program, has weekly conference calls with all treating providers to provide clinical oversight, and she is also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Washington, where she sees HIV and HCV, HIV co-infected patients at the Ryan White Clinic there. Lastly, she's the Corrections Program Director for the Northwest AIDS Education and Training Center and educates correctional providers in the five-state area about HIV and hepatitis C. Dr. Strick?
That was quite the introduction. All right, so Rich kind of gave the epidemiology an overview. I was charged today to talk a little bit more about kind of natural history of hepatitis C and why we care about this disease in general, but a more in-depth discussion on treatment and how it is maybe a little bit different in corrections than it is in the community. I have no disclosures. So starting with natural history. So I think with natural history, the important part here and kind of the thing that people have hung their hat on and has made hepatitis C in general so difficult to really define is this idea that not everyone who has chronic hep C is destined to develop cirrhosis or the last stage of significant scarring of the liver and or die of their hepatitis C. And so, you know, to me, it's kind of which has allowed us or pushed us or put us in positions where we kind of have historically picked and chosen who to treat based on their characteristics and their disease. And we'll talk a little bit more how now, given these new medications that are expensive, has led us to kind of prioritize who gets treated. But when we think of this, you know, there are a lot of other common diseases like diabetes and hypertension that are very chronic diseases that there is a tendency, we treat everyone, right? We don't pick, okay, you're a diabetic, you look more likely to lose a foot, so I'm going to treat you, but I'm not going to treat this person over here with diabetes because I don't think it's going to lead to consequences. In that we as physicians and I think as public health specialists are not always that great about predicting who is going to have future problems with a disease, and so therefore we choose to treat everyone when it is economically feasible. In the natural history of this disease, the issue is that it is slow and it's chronic. And so you can be at a time point today, but really where you're going to have consequences of the disease is to 20 to 30 years later. I think that this graph often is a little bit misrepresented when it's talked about in the public frequently, in that as you can see here, what this is saying is that in about 20 years, about 20 people develop cirrhosis. What that doesn't really tell you, though, is it doesn't mean only 20% of people with hep C develop cirrhosis. Because if someone gets infected, which a lot of people incarcerated unfortunately start using IV drugs around the age of 12, is that if you lived 50 years, potentially 50% of people will develop cirrhosis. So it's not like this is a cutoff point that says only 20% of people develop cirrhosis. It's just that over a certain time period, an increasing number of people are going to get clinical consequences. And eventually, those consequences can be quite severe. Why do we care? We care because of these consequences. And I think what Rich kind of alluded to, the problem here is, as we all know, particularly in public health, is that our society is divided into these financial silos. And so that even though you have a normal liver that goes to a cirrhotic liver, that this time course of disease may or may not happen while the person is inside the correctional facility, and therefore the clinical consequences of disease may or may not happen while the person is still behind bars. Also, as he said, is, you know, and to go back to the epidemiology here, is it is true that over the past couple of years, the CDC has really focused on this idea of baby boomers. And it is true, in our overall society, 75% of this disease is concentrated among baby boomers. And as a result, as these people get to those 20 to 30 years after infection, we are going to see mortality from this disease skyrocket. But what I really would also like to stress, though, is that that concentration of disease among that age group probably is not as concentrated in a correction setting, because unfortunately the risk is much more widespread. And so we don't see, we see a much more larger distribution of hep C across all age groups, and we don't see as much of a focused concentration in corrections. And so to only test people in that age group in a correction setting, again, I think is a strategy that's going to miss a lot of people with this infection. So what are our goals? Why do we treat people? We treat people, the goal of treatment in general, obviously, is to save lives. And we do know that treating hep C does indeed make people, decreases overall mortality. It also decreases liver-related consequences, all of which are very costly to society and result in lots of repeated hospitalizations. And we often talk about this word called sustained viral response. And that's because initially when we started treating hep C, there was not as much clarity of whether it was a true cure or not. I think we truly are at the point where we probably can stop using the word sustained viral response and just say the person is cured. We just, when we start something, we have a hard time getting out of a habit. And so, you know, I think we pretty much have now shown that people who are cured from hep C are truly cured and that it is not coming back unless they are reinfected. The other thing to understand is, you know, for people with hep C, it really, in the ideal situation, and Ben is going to talk about money next, but if money was not an object, not only would we treat everybody, but we really would try to treat people as early in the course of disease as possible, right? Once you start waiting until people get really, really severe liver disease and potentially are at risk of complications, one, your cost effectiveness goes down, but clinically people don't do as well. And the idea of waiting really is, and we'll talk a little bit about, historically was clinically based, and unfortunately now not as much so. So treatment outcomes. This is just kind of a walk through time of all of the different treatment regimens. And so IFN stands for interferon, RBD is ribavirin, and that really had been the crux of therapy over many, many years. And as you can see, the best we ever did with PEG interferon and ribavirin together was about a 50-50 chance that you were going to be cured of the disease. Then we started getting into the age of direct-acting antivirals, and we started out with lisinopril and telaprevir, and we started getting a little bit better. The problem was is that at that time, treatment was still really, really plagued with horrendous side effects. And so even though it was very effective, you had side effects, you had drug-drug interactions, and when Rich showed that care cascade, one of the primary reasons historically that people had not been getting treated was not so much cost. I mean, part of it was cost, but it really was, as a physician, why would you want to put someone through horrendous therapy if they had the chance of getting cured was a flip of a coin, in that there were a lot of clinical reasons why treating people may not have been the best choice. Then you get into, and it looks like for whatever reason we got a weird PowerPoint issue here, but for PEG interferon, ribavirin, and sofosbuvir, suddenly we started getting up to 90%, but we also started shortening treatment significantly. And finally now we have the combination of sofosbuvir and ledipasvir, which now has over a 95% cure rate for most genotypes, is now only 3 months of therapy, and has very limited side effects to almost no side effects. and has very few drug-drug interactions. And so from a clinical standpoint, you know, there's basically three things you look at when you're deciding whether it's worth treating somebody. Right? You want to know what the side effects are and the risk to the patient. You want to know how effective it is and is it worth your time to do this. And then you want to look at cost. And it used to be that all three were barriers to care because it was not particularly effective. It had a horrible side effect profile. And at the time, we thought it was costly. Now, suddenly, you eliminate side effects. You make it extremely efficient. And the only barrier of care now suddenly becomes cost. So what are the advantages of sofosbuvir-based regimens? So again, I've already said superior cure rates, less side effects, shorter duration of treatment, lower pill burden, all oral regimens. You know, it used to be you had to get injections on a weekly basis. Fewer drug-drug interactions, you no longer, because of the limited side effects, a lot of the side effects from the prior regimens required ridiculous amounts of lab monitoring and clinical oversight. And for a correctional system, there were certain nurses that basically were dedicated for Hep C treatments, and it was such a complicated regimen that they spent the majority of their days just seeing Hep C patients because they had to be seen so frequently. So it was a workload issue. There were, especially with the last round of treatments with telaprevir and boceprevir, the food requirements were ridiculous. And in a prison setting, in the community, they were hard enough. In a prison setting, when you start involving medical, mental health, food services, and custody, where you all have to coordinate, it's nearly impossible. And so from a logistics standpoint, some of these older treatment regimens were very difficult, and now that they're so simple, it's much easier to actually accomplish successfully behind bars. These are regimens now also that not only are effective in your average Hep C patient, they're effective pre- and post-transplant, they're as effective in HIV patients because they no longer rely on the immune system for response, but as many of you know, and as Ben is going to highlight, they're just a bit more costly. So treatment outcomes. So this is interesting. You know, I think correctional settings really can be the ideal place to provide treatments. These are patients who frequently in the community are from a marginalized population. They frequently are homeless and are from very low income settings. And you put them in an environment where they have guaranteed housing, they have guaranteed three meals a day, they have one of the most structured lifestyles that there probably is, and it allows them to really inwardly focus on health as a priority, and they suddenly become much more interested in treatment, not because they weren't interested before, but because they now have the luxury of being able to concentrate on their health care without necessarily focusing on all of these psychosocial factors that were interfering in the community. Prisons are a place that have very close clinical oversight, and there is the potential. So I think there often is a misunderstanding of how medications are given out in prisons and jails. Many jails do all of their medications at a pill line or a supervised dosing structure. In prison, we actually limit the number of medications that we give that is supervised dispensing to a minimum, because directly observed treatment is a huge workload. So the majority of medications in prison are actually given out the same way in the community, which I think is not understood. So I write a prescription, the patient goes to a window, they're given a month's supply, they bring it back to their cells, they are completely and independently responsible for taking those medicines. No one is standing there watching them. The reason why they take their medicines so well is not because there is an officer ready to, you know, be on their case. It's because, again, going back to the fact that they have a structured lifestyle, they have housing, they have food, and suddenly their medicine, why not take your medicines? They're right there. I'm not walking around the streets. My medicines aren't getting soaked in the rain. So-and-so is not stealing my backpack. It just becomes a feasible environment to prioritize health care. These medications, though, are so expensive that I would say that it would be a really an exception to the norm to give them KOP, mainly because of the expense of each pill and wanting it, you know, if medications are in the hands of a patient and the patient doesn't take it, those medications unfortunately have to be wasted. If the medications are in the hands of health service staff and a patient misses a pill, those pills technically can be then used for somebody else, in that the pharmacy laws are such that kind of make that price be an issue. Historically, when we used interferon and ribavirin, most of the published data shows that success rates and cure rates in prison actually superseded those in the community. I think for all of the reasons I already mentioned, is that because it is such a supervised setting, and as Rich mentioned, is that although there is drug use, usually the amount of drug use is less in a correctional system than it is on the in the community. And so all of those factors kind of lead to better compliance rates and better success and better completion rates of therapy. I think with these newer regimens, the difference may kind of dissipate because they're such easy regimens. I'm not sure you'll be able to see as big of a statistical difference. But I would say that usually prisons do a really good job getting people to take and complete their therapy once it's started. The issue is getting it started. So getting to this idea of treatment prioritization. So as I already mentioned, if price was not an issue, at this point I think we finally have reached a place in the treatment regimens that from a clinical perspective, there really is not a reason why we would not treat the majority of people with Hep C. But the cost of these drugs have kind of forced us into a artificial environment that we're needing to prioritize who does and doesn't get treated, and that is true both in the community as well as corrections. I think the differences in what we were talking about is that as a provider, though, when I, working in the correctional setting is different than the community, in that in the community, you are always the provider for an individual. In corrections, I am both a provider for an individual as well as a provider for a population. And that is a balance between what is best for an individual versus what is best for a population, and they don't always align. And sometimes a regimen that may be cheaper but effective, but maybe not the ideal, would allow me to treat more patients and better for the population, even though it might sacrifice one thing or another for an individual. And I think that's a difficult balance that you don't encounter in the community. So the big question that has always come up now and is in big debate is how to prioritize. And I think that most people have agreed that you prioritize those that would derive the most clinical benefit, so have the highest risk of complications. What I think becomes really controversial both in the community as well as corrections is how to treat based on transmission and the overall epidemic. So according to, these are taken mainly from a combination of AASLD guidelines and my own opinion, but most people would say the highest priority to currently treat are people who have advanced liver disease, so F3, F4 fibrosis scores, people who are pre or post transplant, people who have severe complications of Hep C that might be outside just the effects of the liver, as well as people who are co-infected with Hep B or, truthfully, other liver diseases that obviously put them at higher risk of getting complications from Hep C. And so a lot of both Medicaids as well as correctional facilities potentially lower the threshold to treat people who have concomitant liver disease, as well as people who have HIV, who because of immunosuppression have a tendency to have faster progression of disease. The problem becomes here is that if you look at the AASLD guidelines, when it talks about transmission reduction benefits, They list incarcerated persons on this list, which to me is kind of silly. I mean, I get it. At the same time, it's kind of silly because working in a correction system, that pretty much would be everyone, and I very clearly can't treat everyone, and so I'm stuck to refer back to the last slide and treat those with the highest priority. And so I don't really know how to implement this recommendation. But there is this huge public health opportunity. And so the big question becomes, what is the role of corrections in this overall societal picture? And I think the thing is we've already mentioned greater than 90%, 95% of people who are in corrections return to the community. And I think what really has to be stressed here is that the people behind bars usually are the populations that get forgotten, and for that population is often not addressed when talking in community forums, including public health forums that are addressing Hep C. And what I would say here is any public health program whose goal is to address the Hep C epidemic needs to include corrections as part of that endeavor to be effective. Because as Rich has already shown you, it's where the crux of the epidemic unfortunately is. And without addressing that population, you're really missing the whole crux of the epidemic. It is the ideal setting in many ways to do every single step of that cascade. The issue becomes resources, and it becomes crucial to really go beyond silos. I mean, unfortunately, the way our country is set up is that once you're in corrections, whether it be jail or prison, you basically become the ward of that facility, and that facility technically becomes financially responsible for their health care. But as we'll talk about, correctional facilities cannot take this on their own. It's just not going to happen because it is potentially not a feasible strategy. So to summarize, I'm just going to split this in the benefits of Hep C treatment, first to talk about treatment for the individual cure. You know, with shortened treatment courses, more people in corrections are going to become eligible for treatment and will be able, I mean, New York is one of the only places that has an effective program to start treatment on the inside and transition them out. Most states don't have those types of programs in place, and if treatment is started on the inside, they inherently have a gap in care. Quotas due to workload issues are no longer valid because these treatment regimens are becoming so easy to do. It used to be that it would overwhelm a facility if they had too many people on treatment because the workload of following these patients was so complex. Now people who previously failed treatment suddenly have treatment options, and so there's many more people who are going to be eligible for treatment who previously were kind of put aside because they weren't able to tolerate interferon and ribavirin. With the Affordable Care Act, you know, there's this question here of, you know, you have a captive audience in corrections, and it potentially is this ideal place to treat people. On the flip side is that corrections, unfortunately, does not fall under the same umbrella as Medicaid, who gets extremely discounted pricing and also gets federally matched in those places that have expanded Medicaid. And so for some states, even though it may be more clinically feasible to treat somebody in corrections, it may be more financially beneficial to treat them in the community. And which is the right place to address this issue? How do we prioritize treatment correctly? And can we defer treatments until the later stages of fibrosis? Unfortunately, what I see often happening here is that as we are restricting more and more who gets treatment, is that if we wait for people to become cirrhotic, unfortunately, whether you treat them or not, you're still left with a cirrhotic. And at least currently, this may change because there is increasing data that if you treat a cirrhotic, their fibrosis might decrease over time. But at least as of right now, what we know is that if you have a cirrhotic, you treat them for Hep C, they're cured of their Hep C, you're still left with a cirrhotic. And they still have the risks, higher risks of hepatocellular liver cancer. They're still left with recommendations to screen them for varices, and they're still left at risk of complications of Hep C disease. Then on the flip side, you have treatment of public health, is that as we've already learned, the majority of the epidemic is behind walls. We need screening programs to identify cases. And that most of these people go back to the community. And so I think eventually, as cost goes down, the true goal of treatment for Hep C at this point should be in line with how we view HIV, which is treatment as prevention, is that the more people we treat, the better the epidemic is going to be. But the only way to do that is to treat people in mass and really tackle corrections. And so this is an opportunity for interagency partnerships in order to tackle this. And I turn this over to Ben, because the biggest question, obviously, is who pays.